Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Fenscast, your monthly podcast from Fens, where we talk to a range of interesting people from the world of European neuroscience. And in this episode, we speak with Gil Costa, who is a scientific designer and illustrator, who initially got his PhD in Universidad de Coimbra, working at Champalimo Foundation, where his research focused on behavioral and neural mechanisms of decision-making and confidence. But Gil currently works as a research graphic designer who supports scientists with their outreach and science communication activities. So he's produced scientific illustrations and covers for publications including Nature Neuroscience and Neuron. And today we chat with him a little bit about his background and his work as a graphic designer in neuroscience. Gil, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Hey, Richard.
So let me start by just asking you, first of all, how did you get into neuroscience in the first place?
So I started neuroscience very early in my career. During my internship, I did a stage in Belgium in a big pharma studying anxiety and depression at the molecular level. And I soon understood that that was not for me, to have to dwell with 1,000 little tubes with very tiny amounts of transparent liquids. I knew that I wanted to do behavior, so something a little bit at a bigger scale. And after my internship, I started my PhD program, just the normal months of courses, until I joined my lab at that time. It was also starting at the Champalimo Research in Lisbon, the lab of Zach Mainen, who was studying indeed behavior. So that was what brought me to neuroscience. Although my first encounter with neuroscience was still at the university level. It was called Human Physiology 2, but it was a lot about addiction and the brain. So I was very interested in knowing all these sorts of crazy compounds, how this affects our brain and our behavior.
Okay, and your PhD focused on decision-making. Can you tell us a little bit about some of that work?
Yeah, so it was about decision-making and especially decision confidence in decision-making. So after I joined Zach's lab, my first PhD project was in innate behavior. I wanted to know if there was some sort of ecological, meaningful signature, innate behaviors, and especially innate fear. I was going to study innate fears in rodents. I had a collaboration with a zoo where I would get some poo from different weird animals like cobras, and Zach allowed me to dwell on this for a couple of months, but he understood it was a little bit too far out. There was already someone at Richard Axel's lab that was going through innate behavior. So we decided to go into what Zach was working mostly, which was decision-making. And they just published a paper on the neurocorrelates of decision confidence in rodents the first time. So basically I went to Cold Spring Harbor at that time, joined as part of the lab there, and took the project from there on. So I didn't initially decide on decision-making, but the decision-making decided on me.
Very appropriate. So then you made the transition into visual communications and scientific illustration. How did that happen? Is that something you were always interested in?
So while at university, I was part of this students' theater group in Coimbra called the Theater Students Group of Coimbra, very appropriately as well. And there I did a bunch of different things. I was an actor, I was a producer, and never directed a play, but I did go into the marketing part. So we needed to kind of put out there our plays, and for that we needed some poster design. So since then I've been trying to understand a little bit Illustrator and Photoshop and creating the posters. And then when I first started the PhD, the first years were kind of silent. I was super focused on the research and the research only. But then because the institute was starting, it was a big thing in Lisbon, we wanted to also have some sort of communication fingerprints, bringing science to the public. We started a set of public talks, big events that whenever some researcher was invited to give a talk at the institute, we selected a couple of them that were very good at public communication, and we started an event, a thematic event around them. So let's say, for instance, food, a big event on food, or a big event on engineering the mind. And for that principle also to reach to a given public, I started creating posters for this group of people. We were basically students and postdocs that were interested in science communication. There was not yet a science communication office. So that's when I started doing design in a scientific setting, not really related to scientists themselves, but related to outreach. So then after my PhD, I did this in parallel with my PhD. When my PhD was over, almost over, Zach came to me and asked me if I needed some help picking a postdoc, how could he assist in my future career. And I told Zach at that time that I think I actually wanted to follow this graphic design thing, especially when I started writing my thesis and creating my figures. I understood that I was getting super excited. I don't know if excited, but I was really into the figures themselves. You know, I was going home and trying to understand how could I do it better, related more to the figures and actually not so much into the data itself. So I decided it was for me. My scientific career was great. I published well. I had a great time. And I needed something else. And that's how I started. I told Zach that I wanted to pursue this. And at that time, the scientific communication office at Champalimau was just being created. They had someone that was writing the content, mostly press releases, these type of things. And they needed someone to do the graphics. Because I had already spent some years with the community developing not only things for the communication initiative, but also material, graphical material for the retreats. Any time that people needed something graphic, they would come to me. They knew me. They trusted my work. And that's where I spent my time, my first initial years.
Right. So when you began, I suppose, what was the biggest change or the biggest difference between that work and your previous work as a researcher and a PhD student, a scientist in the lab?
It's a totally different field. So you have to start from scratch or something. And I had to say that although I had some past doing some iterations and graphic design, there's people that start this and they're very good at drawing and really not good at drawing at all. But I did have a sense of aesthetics just from being interested in the field, going to museums. So apart from that, actually, I think what was very different, but it's related to whenever you move out of academia, is that your time does not belong to you solely in a sense. So as a researcher, the output of your efforts sometimes comes in a couple of years, if you're lucky, actually. And as a PhD student, okay, it's your project, and you have to, of course, respond to your PI, your boss, in a sense. But it's not the same thing. So as a graphic designer, your output of your work comes mostly in a week or in 2 weeks. And your timelines are basically not yours. You know, so the client, which is not the client, but the scientist would come, or the scientific officer would come and say, hey, Gilles, we need a flyer for the next conference that is coming. So time was the biggest difference. But we get used to it. And it's somewhat also exciting to be able to see the results of your efforts sprouting in such a short time.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I'm thinking, as a scientific graphic designer, you probably face a lot of similar challenges to other people in science communication in terms of conveying complex ideas in a way that's accessible to the public or to other groups. But are there specific factors or specific challenges with trying to do that visually that you don't get in other domains? Are there specific kind of problems or difficulties or things to factor in when it comes to visually depicting information?
If you compare to writing, so scientific communication in a writing setting, I think it might be easier to be a professional visual communicator, because I think everyone thinks that they can write, right? So the acknowledgement of skill might not be as great. So in that sense, I think people do trust me a lot on my skills, because it's not so widely used, let's say. At the same time, because of that, the language or the knowledge of the clients or the people that come to me is not so big that the decision that they want to do are so informed. Like I'm going to just pick one example, for instance. If I need something to be reviewed by a client or a scientist in this case, they might not have the vocabulary to describe what they like or they don't like or what they want. So they would pick things which are more common, like, for instance, the colors. Okay, I don't like these colors, or which for me, in that particular case, a color is a function. I use colors as a functional aspect of the work. They should serve a function, not a purpose. And then the space, I guess, like in a visual communication, you have a limiting set of space. It's normally like the size of a computer screen or a poster, or fit all the information in. And that is a challenge. Although, of course, like if you write, you also have like 5,000 words that you have to accomplish with.
Sure. And like that's why they say a picture paints 1,000 words. You know, it's a very...
It's a big effective responsibility, though.
Yeah. That's true. And I know in lots of aspects of science communication, analogies and metaphors can be really useful. Do you use those much at all, or do you go for more sort of descriptive and literal kind of depictions?
It depends. It's a spectrum. I like to, sometimes I give workshops and I like to define this, let's say, the space of possibilities. It's not a term from me, it's a term from Jan Christiansen, the Scientific American art director. And she describes a spectrum that goes from something which is very bound to information. So these are things like when you're doing plots, when you're doing the scientific diagrams. But then it's a spectrum that then goes through graphical abstracts, and it goes until editorial illustrations, such as like what you see in covers. What you see in covers are definitely metaphors. So I like to play with stories on this, and I like to normally, play around. Normally my covers, they are always related to the scientific object, but in an abstract sense. I remember I made the cover for Nature Neuroscience for Megan Carey, that she had a study which was on conditional learning and how movement improves this type of behaviors or this type of learning that first described by Pavlov. So my cover for her work was just a window. You can picture the window, and outside you see a big tree of a Purkinje cell shape and a dog running. By Pavlov, let's say, before the training starts, and inside of the window you see a little bell and a little rodent on top of this bell. So because the work was done in rodents.
Yeah, it does. It sounds like a lot of fun, because effectively it sounds like visual storytelling with symbols and metaphors and concepts. So you must find it enjoyable, do you?
Yes, for sure. Although I always need a balance. So I cannot just do covers, because although they are very, you get very into it and very obsessed about it, but to be able to derive the story is the most important part. The first part that you say, okay, I think I have it. And it cannot just be some sort of, it has to fit on a page, right? So it has to be a visual story. And this part of is a bit tiring, and then you have fun doing it, and then you give it to the scientist, and sometimes it gets selected, most of the times it's not. But I need the balance also with, and I have a lot of fun also doing this other type of diagrams where the exercise is different. It's about layout. It's a little bit like OCD like behavior, where you have to organize your bookshelf according to, I don't know, the authors. I need a balance there. But if I can balance both worlds, it's super fun work to do.
And do you think it's possible to do the job without a background in research? I mean, it feels like it's an advantage for you, but do you think somebody else could come in with no background in science and do the same job?
Yeah, I think so. I have colleagues that do not have a background in science. I think it's harder for them to do some aspects. It might be easier for them to do some others. Mostly these are artists, right? They come from an artistic background where they have some interest in science. And they just pursue different paths. What they do need is a translator somehow, and they need the trust of the scientist, which is, I think that what gives me a lot of advantage in what I do is that I totally understand science. I not only come from a neuroscientific background, but I do have a biology background, so this opens big doors for me. So when a scientist talks to me, it can rest assured that I'm understanding what he's saying, and I have no fear of asking, and the conversation is fluent. What I hear from people that work with designers which are not scientists is that, they did indeed need to describe. I mean, I'm going to draw a caricature here, but they cannot just say, okay, I'm studying a cell, so I need a cell. And the nucleus in the cell and the membrane. They have to say, okay, I need a circle, and then inside the circle another circle. And you see, of course, it's a caricature. But at the same time, again, like these artists that do scientific, that work with for science, they bring other type of skills. There's André Caetano, a very good comic artist from Portugal. He does amazing comics for science with scientists for CNC, which is the Coimbra Neuroscience Institute. I would never be able to do that because I didn't have the time to pursue those skills. So it's a balance. But if you have to deal with science, then I think you need a scientific background. It really helps.
I'm sure it helps with the vocabulary or of what you want to convey or describe. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the NCODS conference that you attended in the past. How did you find yourself there, and what happened at that conference?
That's a nice story. So basically, so ENCODES was at that year was actually being prepared by students from the Champalimau Institute. I was still at the Champalimau. I hadn't defended my thesis yet, but I was already working at the science communication office. So I helped those guys to do the posters, all the visual language. They had a game of cards. I don't know if you know these cards games that, for instance, it used to be like Formula One or the airplanes, and then you could play.
Trumps used to be called.
So they wanted to I did a set of cards for those. I did a bunch of things for them. And in the conference, I also did a workshop on the introduction for graphic design for scientists. So that's where I went to ENCODES. I was still a student. I was also giving training. And indeed, that conference was very important for me because that's where I met my wife in a party. So in the party of ENCODES and the Champalimau. Actually, Zach, I think Zach, my PI, was actually putting the sound. He likes to DJ. He was DJing. I saw this really nice girl. We started chatting. We get along that day, that night. The following days that she stayed in Lisbon, we continued connecting. And then she went back to Trento. So she's a cognitive neuroscientist. She was a cognitive neuroscientist in Trento, which was 10 hours traveling from Lisbon. I met her I went there, and now we live together in Brussels. She actually won the prize of best poster, but she did not attend my workshop. So that's the funny part. She didn't need my expertise.
That's a lovely story, though. That's fantastic. Before we finish, I just wanted to ask, maybe if someone listening to this wanted to follow your path and get into graphical design, visual communication in science, how would you recommend they go about it?
To never give like a step bigger than my leg. I started exploring the job while I was still at the science communication office. Then I was hired to do an exhibition. I expanded a little bit more. So, you know, try to understand what you can do. Use your network as a client. That is another aspect why it's so important, why it might be important to be a researcher before. Is because your clients will be researchers as well. My clients started to be first the people at the Champalimau, and nowadays it expanded to you know, it's no longer word of mouth, although there's still an aspect there of word of mouth. But use your scientific network wisely, and then build your portfolio with things that you want to do, but you don't know yet how to do them. And you might use client work to do that, and you might use pro bono client work to do that. So if you have to, I advise to really pick accurately the pro bono work that you want to do, because all in all, this is a job and you will need to know that your value is out there and your time needs to be paid. But there are some institutions that, because of the aim of that institution or because of the goal, you might be interested in collaborating with them, and you might be use them to explore your skill set and build a portfolio, build your web page and put yourself out there.
Great. It sounds like a lovely career and a really fascinating one and a really important one. So Gil Kostka, thank you so much for joining us this month on the Fenscast, and best of luck with all your work in the future.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Fenscast. Before you go, Fens is delighted to remind you that regular registration for the Fens Forum 2024 just opened. So don't forget to register by 14 May to secure your spot in the biggest neuroscience event in Europe. Fens and the host societies, the Austrian Neuroscience Association and the Hungarian Neuroscience Society, are looking forward to welcoming the whole neuroscience community in Vienna, Austria from 25 to 29 June 2024. Also, if you plan to participate in the FENS Forum 2024, consider joining the European Neuroscience Conference by Doctoral Students, or ENCODES 2024. It's also happening in Vienna from 23 to 24 June. This conference puts PhD students in the driver's seat. It's set up by PhD students for PhD students and is the perfect prelude to the forum. The title and focus for this year's ENCODES meeting is Emerging Technologies in Neuroscience, Unveiling the Next Frontiers. Participants can expect plenary talks, student presentations, poster sessions, several workshops designed to boost careers in neuroscience, and even a scientific speed dating session. Registrations for the meeting are open until 20 April. FENS members and FENS Forum 2024 participants who registered during their early registration period benefit from reduced fees. So mark your calendars, save the date, and get ready for an immersive experience at ENCODES 2024. We can't wait to see you there. Thank you for listening, and join us for the next episode of FENSCast during Brain Awareness Week in March. In the meantime, don't forget to follow us on FENS.org, X, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube to stay updated.